Buy Now. Six Music Documentary.
Hi, I'm Amanda Ghost, and welcome to part two of Coming From The Cold, in which we're celebrating the return to recording of the incomparable Joni Mitchell. Tonight, you'll hear more of a very candid and detailed conversation I had with Joni at her house in Los Angeles. We discussed everything from her classic album Blue to other 70s releases like For The Roses and Cord and Spark. We'll play the hit song she told me she wrote as a joke, and we'll hear about the ballet that opened recently in her native Canada, featuring her songs and her art. We've also got some more exclusive music from her album Shine, including her new version of Big Yellow Taxi. But first, we're talking about more of the early covers of Joni's songs. This one went around the world.
I came upon a child of God. He was walking along the road, and I asked him, "Where are you going?" And this he told me, "I'm going on down to Yasgur's farm. I'm gonna join in."
You've been covered so many times by so many different artists. Do you find that a big compliment as an artist? I mean, how do you feel about
it? Well, John Lennon came into Court and Spark dates. He was recording across the hall, and he came in with Harry Nilsson one night, and he was drunk, and he listened back to something, and he went, "Oh, it's all a product of your education. You want a hit, don't you? Why you always let somebody else have your hits for you?" That's what he said. And I guess in a way I did, you know, either people came to me and wanted to record a song and saw an opportunity, like Woodstock, you know, with CSN. The timing for it was kind of ripe for it to be a hit, no matter who recorded it. So I let them usurp that opportunity, but I never really wanted to be, well, actually it was a little sketchy, let's be honest here. I never really wanted to get into the rat race of being a hit maker. Simultaneously, I did feel, you know, all my friends were on the radio and I wasn't, you know, and I did feel like...
That's human nature, though.
Yeah, I wished my stuff was on the radio, but by the same thing, I watched the pressure that they were under, because once you have a hit, you got to keep writing a hit, and who knows what a hit is? I mean, the company said, you know, "Come on, Joan, write us a hit," and I said, "I thought my idea was to write you a song and you make it a hit. I can't make it a hit, you know, that's your job."
The song that blew me away, I mean, literally, stopped my heartbeat, was A Case of You. And it just was. You are in my blood like holy wine, you taste so bitter yet so sweet, and I could drink a case of you and I'd still be on my feet. Joni, I think that's one of the best lyrics ever written. I mean, I really do. And what I wasn't aware of, as I started to get to know your music, was how many young girls, like me, have sat in their bedrooms listening to Blue, over and over and over, and just knowing that you speak our pain, our loves, our
hopes. It's a good transitional teenage record.
Yes.
I mean, even though it was written a little later than that, but I mean, I think it's a good thing for a girl in that, which is generally, you're supposed to get your angst out in your teens, although sometimes if people have a delayed reaction.
Better
in your teens.
Came out in my 20s.
Came out in my 20s. But it's got to be done when you're young. I've seen it come out in people in their 50s, and they give themselves bursitis or something. You need to get through that to get the inoculation while your body's young enough to take it.
Just before our love got lost, you said, I am as constant as a northern star, and I said, constantly in the darkness, where's that at? If you want me, I'll be in the bar, on the back of a cartoon coaster, in a blue TV screen light. I drew a map of Canada. Done it twice. Oh, you're in my blood like holy wine. You taste so bitter and so sweet. Oh, I would drink a case of you, darling, and I would still be on my feet. Oh, I would still be on. Love is touching souls. Surely you touch my anchor. Hardy, you pours out of me in these lines from time to time. Oh, you're in my blood like holy wine. It tastes so bitter and so sweet. Oh, she said, go to him, stay with him if you can, but be prepared to bleed. Oh, but you are in my blood, you're my holy wine, you're so bitter, bitter and so sweet, oh, I could drink a case of you. I would still be on my feet.
It's considered one of the greatest albums of all time, Blue. And that sounds very weird, me saying that as you're sitting right in front of me.
It was one thing that distinguishes it, you know, I don't think it's my best or my only good one, and it gets more attention, really, than it's due. But one thing to its credit is, at the time that it was recorded, and I could show you on later albums the absence of this, and then on later ones gaining it back. But the thing about it was that, you know, I couldn't look at people without weeping. I mean, my jive detector, like all drowning people, was set so low, and there was almost a psychic thing where I could see through people, and I was sure that they could see through me. It felt like we were all cellophane, but that was recorded during that time period. So I was incapable of guile. I mean, you need a certain amount of guile for self-defense in certain, you know, friendly jive, fooling around. I didn't have that, so I was just dripping in earnestness and sincerity. I'd lost my sense of humor. As a result, there is, it's like the London Philharmonic, when real emotion is real emotion. And there is a lot of stuff that doesn't date because we're still going through that change, like the Blue.
It's timeless.
There's so many sinking now, you got to keep thinking you can make it through these waves. You know, acid, booze, and, you know, all the drug pitfalls that kids are heir to. In that way, it's a good... It's like Kipling's, come on, you know, Blue and Kipling's If have a lot in common. It's like you're down to the bare bone.
I couldn't imagine. I mean, if somebody wrote a record like Blue today, you know, they'd probably put it to one side and say, there's no radio hits on it, forget it, you know, or whatever.
Well, yeah.
But when you delivered that record to the label, I mean,
they're very nonplussed. As a matter of fact, my own peer group was horrified by it. Chris Christopherson, I played it for him, and he went, Joni, save something of yourself. Because it was unprecedented in its vulnerability in a certain way, but it was all I was capable of, you know.
I mean, it definitely was. I mean, it must have, I don't think there could have been a record out there that was that personal, right? I mean, you were definitely
Mm-mm.
crossing a line
mm-hmm.
as an artist, I think.
I'm bad, I'm bad, look at me, I'm happening. I mean, that's how you present yourself, like in pop, right?
It's true.
You don't go, you know, I'm selfish and I'm sad, you know, which is the human condition, you know.
Very true. Was it a success, Blue, by the way? Was it a commercial success?
No.
It wasn't?
Over the years, yes. I mean, because people that discovered it wore it out and passed it on, and, you know, I guess it's probably gone multiple platinum at this point.
Is it your biggest selling album
mm-hmm.
to this day? I think it is, right?
Well, it's the most hyped album, you know, so
right.
And people are sheep, so...
And then it was followed by The Roses.
Yeah.
For the Roses.
Which actually is my favourite album.
Is it?
Of all your records. It is mine. And only because, again...
Yeah, because you went through that
space. I went through that space. Exactly. You know, I mean, yeah. I was at the point when I had delivered my first album for Warner Brothers, and it had come out and it had been critically acclaimed, which is the kiss of death for most artists, and but never got on the radio, and so subsequently didn't sell many records. And suddenly I was being called into these meetings of men in suits asking me to write radio hits.
Yeah.
You know, and a man, you know, and I was they wanted me to wear sexy clothes, and they had lots of meetings about whether or not my hair should be straight or curly. And
I saw the feather bra. I was horrified. This picture of Amanda in a feather bra, you know, like she's a jeans and no makeup girl. You know, I went, oh my God, what are they doing? They'll be putting a ruby in her navel.
It's so funny. And I remember talking to you about it, going, Joan, for the Roses. Oh my God, it's just. This is what I am going through. You know, I heard it in the last night. It sounded like applause. You know, I mean, that song was exactly what I was going through. And I remember you turned to me. Oh God, I remember it so clearly. And you have no idea how much it influenced my life as an artist. After you said it, you said to me, Amanda, you know, you've got to make up your mind.
Which do you want to be?
Which do you want to be? Yeah. A star, a rock and roll star, or an artist? And, you know, I didn't know what you meant. And I remember sitting there kind of smiling as you said it, thinking, she doesn't know what she's talking about. I can be both. She doesn't, you know, I can...
No, you got to know from the start before, because once you compromise, if you want to be a star, compromise. And you'll be short-lived, you know, and you'll maybe get a bigger splash, but you'll go down and you won't have yourself. If you want to be, you want to be an artist, you have to start fighting from the beginning and never stop. You have to fight them all the way. So, you know, you have to know what you are at the beginning.
Heard it in the wind last night, sounded like applause. Did you get around resounding for you way up here? Seems like many dim years ago since I heard that face to face, or seen you face to face. Though tonight I can feel you here. I got these notes on butterflies and lilac sprays from girls who just have to tell me they saw you somewhere. In some office sits a poet, and he trembles as he sings, and he asks some guy to circulate his soul around. On your mark, red ribbon runner, the caressing rev of motors, finely tuned like fancy women in 30s evening gowns. Up the charts, off to the airport, your name's in the news, everything's first class. The lights go down and it's just you up there, getting them to feel like that. Sit and make up your tunes for love and pour your simple sorrow to the sound all in your need. And now you're seen on giant screens and at parties for the press and for people who have slices of you from the company. They toss around your latest golden age speculation. Well, who's to know if the next one in the nest. Them so. I guess I seem ungrateful with my teeth sunk in the hand that brings me things I really can't give up just yet. Now I sit up here, the critic, and they introduce some band, but they seem so much confetti looking at them on my TV set. For worship they start bringing out the hammers and the boards and the nails. Heard it in the wind last night, sounded like applause. Chilly now
end of summer, no more shiny hot nights. It was just the arbutus rustling and the bumping of the logs, and the moon swept down black water like an empty spotlight.
I watched the prediction of the black church when, you know, when gospel was usurped for rock and roll, and they were the first to say, you know, this is the devil's music. Well, you go back to early rock and roll and you say, how can this be devilish? And white people were scared of it too, because it was creating movement below the waistline. You know, I mean, we were still being held at ruler's edge on the dance floor. They literally come around with a ruler to keep you apart.
Back like, in 1957,
yeah,
they used to dance a foot apart.
They're just standing there with their rulers without a heart, you know, on the side. No close dancing was allowed. And so this stuff hits, and it's so innocent and joyous.
The biggest validation for me ever as an artist was when I wrote that song. I wrote a song called Blood on the Line, which I wrote kind of at the end of my tether at Warner Brothers. And the biggest compliment ever was that, because I was always scared about ever playing you anything I did. So I was like, oh my God, finally, I've done something good. It didn't matter what anyone else thought in the world.
No, you really liked
my song.
Can I count you as my friend? The way your loyalty can bend. One day it's light and then it's black. That heavy pressure on my back. I don't know how to read sign. Lord, I must be blind. That's my blood on the line. I don't know how to shut my mouth. No other way to let it out. I have a voice that won't be heard. An empty cage without a bird. I don't know how I missed the sign. Lord, I must be blind. That's my blood on the line. Deafen in your ears. I don't understand the signs, but Lord, I know I'm not blind. But that's my blood on the line.
I was so glad to like it because it was at a time I didn't like any music. I didn't like any music. I didn't like my music. I hated music. I'd come to hate music. I listened only to talk shows 10 years. I couldn't listen to anything. And then Starbucks, of all places, saved me. Starbucks came out with this limited edition of Artist Choices. And my management gave me a couple of them, which I didn't like either. I didn't like the music on them. But I thought, could I do one of these? So, you know, they let me do one. Well, there was only supposed to be, I think, 12 songs on it or something like that. I couldn't get it to go. I listened to everything I ever loved and to see what would hold up, and much held up. And I put together one that starts with Debussy, and then it kind of takes a journey up through Duke Ellington and Billie Holiday and Miles, and then into Louis Jordan. I had Louis Jordan records before rock and roll was called rock and roll. And they were great storytelling, party time records. House of Blue Lights I had, and the Saturday Night Fish Fry, and they were party records, right?
Stopping at the Saturday Night Fish Fry. It was rocking. It was rocking. You never cease that scuffling and shuffling till the break of dawn. It was rocking. It was rocking. You never cease that scuffling and shuffling till the break of dawn.
And then, of course, along came Chuck Berry, who to me is still the definitive rock and roller, you know, in terms of rock and roll writing and playing. And that's the birth of the art, where it makes this little jump. Basically, the jump was from him playing boogie-woogie piano on guitar. It's just boogie-woogie, but it's guitar emphasized instead of piano. So it's going from jitterbug. It's not that big a jump from one era, and it's still swinging. Once it turned into rock and roll, what they call rock and roll, which was had no roll in it, had no black jitterbug, it had no swing era. I'm a swing era baby, you know. There's still joy, and that joyous music was conceived in such terrible times, and it was such a great relief to the culture at the time. That's the trouble with now. We've got a horrible culture, horrible times, and horrible music, and nobody, you know. All at the same time, it couldn't be any worse, you know, when your music is horrible too. Ah!
I read that Court and Spark was your biggest hit record. It spawned the most hits. Help me.
Well, it's the only radio hits that I had. And at one time, from a Bean Corp counter's perspective, it was the biggest seller. Right. But over time, Blue overtook it. So, and that's what...
And did you consciously sit down on that record and think, I'm going to write songs to get on the road? Did you ever take that into account when you
only wrote once. Geffen pestered me to write a radio hit, and I said, you know, I said to him, I think I may have said this, it's my job to write a good song, it's your job to make it a hit. Like, even the song about Geffen, you know.
Free Man in Paris.
You Free Man in Paris, you know, like, the star, stoking the star maker machinery. That's your job, you know, like, you make it a hit. I wouldn't know a hit if it bit me on the ankle. All the hits I've had, I wouldn't call them hits.
To decide, you know I go back there tomorrow, but for the work I've taken on, stoking the star maker machinery behind the popular song.
as a joke, I wrote, "You Turn Me On, I'm a Radio." But I said, okay, I'll write you a hit. So it was completely tongue-in-cheek. You know, it was all, okay, how would you write a hit if you were going to contrive it? Well, first of all, flatter the DJ, right?
Right? Absolutely.
So, you know, it's got all that, you know, like the radio tower and all that, you know, like tipping the hat. But it was a joke. And that's the only time I ever tried to write a hit, and only as a joke.
I'm a country station, I'm a little bit corny.
Driving into town with the dark cloud above you, dialing the number who's bound to love you. Oh, honey, you turn me on, I'm a radio, I'm a country station, I'm a little bit. To wear. I'm gonna tell you again now if you're still listening there. If you're driving into town with the dark cloud above you, dialing the number who's bound to love you. If you're lying on the beach with the transistor going, kick off the sand, cause honey, the love's still flowing. If it says forget that your heart's still smoking, call me at the station.
Next, I asked Joni about an album that included a great song, where she makes a reference to Kilauen, the daughter she'd given up for adoption as a teenage single parent. The song comes from the mid-1980s, and to the great interest of the world's media, mother and daughter would be reunited in 1997.
So, Joni, moving on through your prolific career, Wild Things Run Fast.
Well, Wild Things was a total commercial disaster on every level, for two reasons. One, at that time I found my dream band, and where the chemistry was right. This, you know, it was just this power quartet, and we all pulled together like a dream. And that was completely out of vogue. Drum machines had come in, so we were against, my timing was off, and it was my time to die anyway, because you only get a decade. That artist from the 60s, well, I came in the tail, they wanted to make me that artist from the 60s, but I trickled over into the 70s. They're trying to hold you down to a decade, and the bosses, who are, you know, were pornographic pigs, they're looking especially at a female, oh, she's getting old now, she's just about 27, you know, like, so they want to dispose of you and get a 14-year-old in there, you know. The other thing, because it was a live band, we took a lot of flack for that, and simultaneously I fell in love and got married. And they counted it up, they went, oh, gag, she used the L word 44 times or something. So love, come, yes, I do, I love you. You know, that repeats a lot. The L word came up so many times, and that was nauseating in a very cynical period. So we were, the album got lost, we toured it anyway.
I wanted to talk to you about Chinese Cafe, because, again, I came to Chinese Cafe on that compilation Hits and Misses. I remember listening to that song, and, you know, when you talk about your kids are growing up straight, my child's a stranger, I bore her but I did not raise her. I could not believe somebody had written a lyric that personal.
Well, if I sing it, like, I feel like a method actor. If I sing it, I'm kind of a method actor. I guess I would probably be a good method actor because I have sense memory. You know, when I get to, like, I'm in a fairly good mood. I'm a little sick right now, like I've got this flu, but I'm generally in a good mood. But if I start thinking about bad things that happened to me, I'll go right back into the feeling. So when you say, what did you think about the song? If I'm performing it well, I'll relive every moment like it was now. But there's a lot of feelings in my songs.
Did you have any idea when you were writing that lyric in Chinese Cafe that it would be so pounced upon, that people would make such a hullabaloo about it?
No, well, it takes a real petty, dirty, you know, conniving, stinking, rotten, low-life person to do it.
Caught in the middle, Carol, we're middle class, we're middle-aged, we were wild in the old days, birth of rock and roll days. Now your kids are coming up straight, and my child's a stranger I bore her, but I could not raise her. Nothing lasts for long, nothing lasts for long, nothing. Up sleek concrete, tearing the old landmarks down, paving over brave little parks, ripping off Indian land again. How long, how long? Short-sighted businessmen, and nothing lasts for long, nothing lasts. When we were those kids' age, nothing lasts for long, nothing lasts for long, nothing lasts for long.
Don't let the Chinese Cafe, we'd be dreaming on our dimes, we'd be playing.
Oh, my love, my darling, I've hungered for you.
Doggy dog,
What is this ballet that you've been working on?
Well, it started off while I was working on the art show, and before I started recording, I got wind that they were going to do a ballet in Calgary of my music. There were to be three ballets presented that night by three different choreographers in February. The first one is a classic Tchaikovsky with a long tutus, and the second is a Schubert. I don't know much about it. And the third one was to be mine. So they can do it, just, you know, I just have to give permission. It really didn't have anything much to do with me, but the choreographer came down to take a visit, and he saw the model, because I had a mock-up of the gallery and I was hanging it on my pool table. And he went, oh, we must have these French, you know, we must have these images in the ballet. So I went, well, I looked at the repertoire that he chose, and it was quite young, because they had a young Australian prima donna who looks like my daughter, my granddaughter, Daisy. I mean, she looks like an 8-year-old. She looks so young, blonde, blue-eyed. So they'd chosen all Chelsea Morning and all these very early young pieces. I said, well, you know, you can't put that art with that music. He said, well, put together, you know, I want to use the art in the ballet, put together the music. So I started to do it. Well, most of the music that would suit it came from Dog Eat Dog, which was my least popular album. They hated it so much they buried it for 20 years. I had to dig it out and, you know, beg them to reopen it and put it out under another name, the beginning of Survival. So I did a re-release packaging on it. So, you know, I thought, well, I said, if we do this, it could be very controversial. To do it, it would be my most unpopular music. Are you willing to stick your neck out like that? And it also has very big drums on it, you know, which people don't necessarily like, and I've taken a lot of criticism for that. No, no, this would be fantastic, you know.
I've just been listening to your new record that you've just done, which is the first one you've written in 10 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first time you've played the piano.
In 10 years.
And so what...
Well, actually, Nate, because, you know, I've had the four piano melodies. The first one, which is called, I think we call it, we nickname it Gratitude, which is really what it is. The first one was born, I was up in my house in Canada, and I was just so happy. I was in the country, I was in the wild, it was beautiful, my big blue heron was there. I was self-sustaining, I was poking in my garden, I was feeding myself, I was living alone and taking care of myself, and every time I stepped outside, the view was breathtaking. And I was just kept getting happier and happier and happier. And I went in and I played that, which is a hymn of gratitude. You can hear it in it, you know, it was just thank you, thank you, thank you. And then the other melodies started to come. And they were like a suite. They have kind of a kindredness to them, although they have slight different character. And once I had four of them, you know, I thought, well, what am I supposed to do with these? They're sort of semi-classical. One has a little bit of 50s Brill Building kind of chordal, you know, for about four bars, but the rest of it is kind of Joni music.
Thank you.
Whenever I hear a female singer-songwriter coming out on the scene, they're always touted as the next Joni Mitchell, and I don't know whether or not you find that a compliment. I find it quite annoying.
No, I think it's a social sickness. It does both of us a disservice. I'm not that easily imitable. And then what always happens with those poor girls is they're very flattered the first year, and by the time they're slandering with me, by the time their second record comes out.
I'm sitting here thinking, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Joan, do you understand how revered you are? I mean, I know that they go up. I mean, you're giving these examples.
No, because you are
so revered.
Not in the press. No, I'm conspicuously in the media. I'm always, oh, what are you doing with her? It's like, no, in the media, I'm conspicuous. There's no one like it. I'm an uppity female. Okay, we've assimilated our blacks. Now we kind of revere them, but we still not sure about women. I know I'm as good and better than most, but I'm not given my fair shake.
You know, what inspired you to come back? What inspired you to put it to tape again?
I had these four piano pieces. Suddenly I had these four, 10 years of nothing, and suddenly I had these four semi-classical piano pieces. No words or anything, and I didn't know what to do with them, but I thought, well, some record should be kept of them. That's basically what a record is. It's not enough for an album, but the EPs had come along, and maybe I'll just make an EP or something, you know, just make it available to my fans, you know, people that collect everything.
You're following.
It'll be interesting to them, you know. I mean, I should go in and record it. So once I got in there, of course, then I've been doing something that I don't usually do. Bands do it all the time, and that is creating music while I'm in there. I usually do, maybe I have 9 songs when I go in and create one, but here I came in with 4 and had to create everything, you know. And I told them that I wanted to orchestrate these pieces and to get me a good orchestral synth. You know, I just need a good studio and, you know, and a good palette of, you know, oboe and strings and blah, blah, blah. I knew I was going to go in that direction.
Listening to what you just played me just then, what struck me, what was quite interesting about it is what I think about a lot of your work is it kind of transcends all genres. Your music, I can't really sit there and say, well, this is, I hate it when people say, oh, that's Joni Mitchell jazz record, or that's Joni Mitchell's electronic record, or I don't like talking about music like that. And what you've just played me just now transcends all that. Again, it's back to what I think is so great about what you do. It's the basics, you know, it's you, piano, it's...
Well, a real artist is going to like a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it's going to take them their lifetime to assimilate that into something hopefully new.
Yeah.
And it's not going to happen when you're young. And this is youth-driven. It's more like painting. Everybody knows, or they used to, now that's even a youth market, that it takes a long time to distill all of this, and you don't become a master until you're in your 50s and 60s. But this is a youth-driven market. I'm only now getting to the place where I feel authentic, that what I really love is maturing, you know, like you can see it in my compositions now, you know, the influence of Debussy and Duke Ellington, and those are my real roots. I had to get these, you know, Bad Dreams Are Good and The Great Plan, and If I Had a Heart, I'd Cry. I had to get those alarming songs out. No, they're not going to be pleasant. You're not going to want to start your day with them, you know? Like, and I'm trying now to forget about the world, you know, like while I'm making this music, and just make some cheery music for the moment to intersperse into it without hopefully making the album schizophrenic. I mean, I don't want to make it go up, down, up, down, up, down, because it's got this heavy stuff that that's the main thing that I suffer from, and, you know, all my life is this overview.
The melody and the piano and the arrangements are beautiful, you know. I mean,
look, I love making making art. I'm compulsive. I'm drawn to do that. I just don't like being the front person for it. Much too much attention is placed on the artist, and much too little on the art, frankly, and that's my great frustration. Although, you know, where I do get, there came a point where even the people on the street who approached me with great warmth and gratitude, you know, that the people that have been helped through this situation or that situation by the work that make you feel like you've served a purpose in that way. At one point, like I was talking about quitting, and there was a waitress there, and she was waiting our tables, and she overheard it, and she burst into tears and said, "You can't quit. You don't understand." And she revealed to me, and she'd waited on me for a couple of years without mentioning anything, but hearing that I was going to quit, she then said, you can't, you know, we need you. And I went, you know, this is so touching, but you know what? This is how far gone I am. Even this touching encouragement from you isn't going to change me. It's just not worth it to me, you know, to stay in an industry where the character of the man is so disgusting to me and perverse. You know, I just don't even be associated with it. Or I'm dreaming that slime, you know, my nightmares are all about, you know, stepping into slime unprotected. You know, I just have to distance myself from that and get out in the country and just live. So I did that for 10 years.
In a few minutes, we'll have a listen to Joni's new version of Big Yellow Taxi. But first, here's part of another track on the upcoming album, inspired by Rudyard Kipling's If.
Call the LA River, which is just a kind of a trough, but it got really polluted, and they spent billions and billions to clean it up. And in the process, they learned a little bit of how. God knows what the consequences of how they did it, because there's always a downside to the upside, you know, but they seem to have made it kind of healthy again. So the mayor of Seoul, Korea, and the mayor of Los Angeles have become sister cities because they've polluted their river terribly. So our mayor is lending that technological knowledge to Korea to clean up in Seoul, you know, to clean up the river. And I heard him on the radio going, "So you can unpave paradise," is what he said. So that's my optimism with this stuff, is that on one level or another. But on this album, it really came from a position of hurting. So they're sadder than Big Yellow Taxi. When you send in Big Yellow Taxi as comic relief, you know, the preceding song is pretty sad, but it's sad, you know, like what's happening, and maybe people need to experience, if they can tolerate it, to experience that sadness, feel it thoroughly, and get inoculated, and then try on some small regional level to contribute a little bit to, but quickly, because time's running out.
The pit paradise put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in the tree museum, and they charged all the people an arm and a leg just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? The paved paradise put up a parking lot.
hope you enjoyed that chat with Joni Mitchell as much as I did. Just to show you how much fun she is and how the media image of her being some sort of solemn recluse is so way out of line, while we were packing up to leave, Joni told us a joke.
The chicken goes into a library and says to the librarian, "Book!" Librarian says, "How interesting, a chicken that reads." You know, sticks a book in its beak and the chicken waddles off. Next day the chicken comes back again and he says to the librarian, "Book, book!" She says, "Oh, this is a reading chicken, you know." So she puts a book under each arm of the chicken waddles off, and the next day he's back, and he says to her, "Book, book, book!" She says, "Yeah, I wish more people would read like this. You know, this is a literate chicken, you know." She picks out three books she thinks the chicken would like, sticks one in the beak, one under each arm. Chicken waddles off, and then the fourth day it's back. "Book, book, book, book!" And she says, "Well, I'm going to have to help this bird." So she sticks one in the beak, one under each arm, and she follows the chicken carrying the fourth book. Comes to a pond. And books are lying all around the edge of the pond. And out in the middle of the pond sits a bullfrog. The chicken takes a book and hops really quickly from lily pad to lily pad, lily pad to a rock in the middle, and hands the frog the book. And the frog says, "Read it."
Six Music.
Six Music is
Six Music.